So when I was in college, I have this memory of there was a year or so where I was not part of a on-campus Christian group. I was attending church here, and I was part of the ministry here, but it was a small ministry, and I didn't have a lot of really close friends as part of the ministry. So I have these memories during that year of going to church and going to our college meeting, and then afterwards, not knowing what to do. It was Sunday, it was like noon, I was a college student, and you don't want to go back and start studying like at 12:30, right? Maybe some of you did. But I was like, I'll start studying at like 4 or 5, but like, I want to do something, and yet I didn't really have a crowd of people to do something with. And so what I would do a lot of times is I would just get in my car and I would drive up into the hills. And there was this one road, I'm forgetting the name, but it was up by Stanford. I would just drive up there, and eventually this road dead-ended. And you kind of walk down into this ravine area where there was a creek, and I would walk along that creek, and I would just walk by myself, and I would pray sometimes and just kind of be out in nature because I didn't want to study yet. But I wasn't happy, because I don't like being alone, and I much would have preferred to have some group of people to go do something with. So it was always this kind of feeling of like looking around and, all right, I guess I'll just go drive by myself, right? And there was something pleasant about it, like, because it was outside and it smelled nice and it was kind of this serene moment, but ultimately, I would way rather have been with somebody. I'm that type of person where I will not usually choose to be alone unless that's the only option available to me. And so there was this kind of sadness mixed with appreciation, but mostly just sadness, right? So the question we want to start by thinking about is, what makes it hard to be single? Some of you are single, and by single I mean not married. So dating, engaged, kind of this period of life, everybody has been single for a large portion of your life. So what are some of the difficulties? I know there aren't many, but associated with being single? Or that you've heard?
You know. Parents.
Maybe you don't feel this. What's that?
Parents.
Parents. Interesting, okay. Like, do they leave when you get married, or...? Like parents bugging you about being single?
Yes.
Ah, right, okay. Parents, subtle hints, right? All right, what else?
Brunch.
How so?
You're not dating anybody, you can't go to brunch.
What are you talking about? Maybe dudes can't go.
Okay, I'm not sure which place. It's not a thing? Yes, Christine.
When you're sick and you need medicine, and so you yourself have to go and get the medicine because there's no one to be in sickness.
Where do you get medicine? CVS, Walgreens, where do you go?
I go to wherever's closest.
What's closest?
CVS, the
store, like 7-Eleven.
7-Eleven? Alright, you need to start going to CVS. They have better medicine. What else?
Follow the homeless guy at the back of the 7-Eleven. He has way better
terms. That's probably true. Good point.
Valentine's Day.
Valentine's Day, okay. Just that it exists,
yes.
Basically? Is that
Single Awareness Day.
All right, what else?
Constantly moving.
April. What? Constantly moving. April, what did you have?
I was thinking something similar, kind of like in transitions, it's like you go alone and nobody comes with you. So like every time you're starting over, you can start like completely over.
David.
So, like, if you, like, live by yourself and If you get a heart attack, no one will know.
Oh, man.
Wow.
Having a heart attack alone. What? Okay, Stefan.
Extraordinarily quiet evenings. I don't really know how to spell extraordinarily, so I'm just going to say EX. Christine.
Taxes.
Taxes.
Oh.
I don't eat as well.
I don't have someone to eat my food.
That's very true.
Really?
I don't have someone to eat other people's food.
Okay, what else?
If you want to go dancing, you have to like drag random men with you.
Random men dancing.
Not being invited
to couple-y things. We should collect all of our YAF whiteboards and then play a game where you have to guess the question I have.
That's good.
Right?
Yeah. Someone take a picture.
People force you to do the garter toss or
vocation. Ooh, garter toss.
Yeah,
oh, just weddings in general.
The inevitable question, when are you going on Match.com?
Oh.
Yeah. Or if you're on it, did you find anyone yet?
How about lack of accountability?
Yes. Lack of accountability. Mm.
Related to that, every decision you make, you have to make it by yourself.
Mm. That sounds great.
No sound.
Yeah, and like all the responsibility is on you. Like you can't share responsibilities with someone.
You have to do all your own chores.
Exactly.
People's perception of you changes.
How so?
They look down on you, maybe, because they see you as immature or young or impulsive. Unsettled.
You sure that's because you're single?
Not exclusive.
You're a softball. There's one more, right?
No sense.
Thank you. We've been talking about it for like a month or whatever. Right? What's the matter?
That's under quiet
eating. Is that right? Can you buy it with two? Is that an argument for polygamy? Okay, we need to be done with this. Alright, so we got a list. This is what makes it hard to be single. So tonight we're talking about singleness, obviously. There's lots of stuff that make being single hard, and yet we're going to talk tonight about some of these things and how some of them get resolved when you're not single, how some of them don't, how God's in that, how this whole thing's kind of a little bit crazy how it works out. We're in the middle of 1 Corinthians. If you've been with us, you know we're doing this series called The New Life, and we're looking at this picture of what it looks like to live the life of the gospel. And we've observed a couple other times that it seems like the Corinthians had written Paul a letter that we don't have. So we don't know what they said to him, but we know what he said to them. And so a couple times he references this letter that they had apparently written. And it seems like in particular this chapter is probably one of those cases where they had asked him several questions, and he is going through their questions answering them. So it seems likely they asked him about when you're married, what does sexual intimacy look like? And so that's the section we looked at 2 weeks ago about sexuality and marriage. Seems like they asked him, what should singles do? And how should we live? And so he addresses that in this passage. Seems like they asked him about when it's okay to get divorced. Once you're married, how do you know when it's okay to separate? And then it seems like they asked him about what do you do when you're married to an unbeliever? And what's the right way to handle that situation? So we already looked at one of those topics. We're going to look at the other three tonight. And we're going to do a little bit of thinking because Paul's writing to a culture that is a first century Greco-Roman culture that works very differently than our culture. So he's going to give certain instructions to them, and we're going to have to do some thinking about, well, how do we make those instructions relevant to us? And in particular, this whole category of dating, this whole idea of being single prior to being married, really hardly existed at all. So the practice of dating and all of the kind of questions that we want answers to about what's okay and what's not okay. But we shouldn't have that up yet. Yeah, go back. That's all right. I'm giving away my thunder. A lot of the questions we want answered, they simply aren't addressed because those weren't contemporary issues. So we're going to try to figure out how we can apply these things. The three big questions we'll think about is, what does it look like to be single? What does it look like to be with somebody? What does it mean to stay married? And then how do you find the right person? What are the guidelines for finding people that you might want to marry? All right, so I'm going to start off by reading 1 Corinthians 7. This is, I didn't write down the passage to read here. 6 through 9. Okay. Now, as a concession, not a command, I say this. I wish that all were as myself, as I myself am. Weird grammar. And by that he means unmarried. By that he means single. But each one has his own gift from God, one of a kind and one of another. One of one kind and one of another. To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am, but if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. All right, that's a little tricky, right? All right, better to marry than to burn. We like that phrase. Okay, so first thing he says is this idea, it is good for them to remain single. He says, I wish that all were as I myself am. To the unmarried and the widows, I say, it is good for them to remain single as I am. So, we got a list of things that make it not good to be single. And here's Paul saying, it is good for them to remain single. You might also recall that in Genesis 2, God said very specifically about the man, it is not good for the man to be alone. And if you've heard teachings, sermons on marriage, often that's emphasized to say God is aware that this state of aloneness isn't ideal, and so he creates the woman and gives marriage, and this is his solution. So how do you have God saying in Genesis it is not good and Paul saying here it is good? Those seem to be opposite. So I think one answer to that question is simply that in Genesis, when it says it is not good for man to be alone, man was really alone. It wasn't just single, he was like single, like there was nobody else, right? There was no yaf, there was no church, there was no roommates, there was no anything. It was just him and all the animals that he named, right? And so the aloneness in Genesis is of a completely different kind. And so if we rethink about Genesis, we can realize that what God was doing was creating relationships in general. And so part of this aloneness and part of a lot of this is solved not just by marriage, but by community, by friends, by connecting with other people. So that's, I think, how Paul can say it is good for them to remain single. But what does this mean, right? Well, so being alone then doesn't equal being single. So being single doesn't mean that you're alone. And for the extroverts in the room like me, this is a difficult one to swallow, but being alone doesn't mean being lonely. Now, that's, you know, some people really enjoy being alone, and that's great. For some people, they don't. And so being alone does feel lonely. But actually, this was told me before I got married, and I experienced it to a surprising depth. But the loneliness that you can feel when you're with somebody physically, but not with them emotionally, or you're in the midst of conflict, is far deeper than the loneliness you can feel when you're actually by yourself. So it's a lot more lonely to be in a relationship where there's conflict or to be in a bad moment than it is to be actually alone. So for me, I kind of went into marriage thinking this is great. I feel lonely. After church, I had no one to eat lunch with. I drove into the woods because I had nothing to do. Now I've got a wife. No more loneliness, right? Wrong. There were times in marriage where the loneliness was more acute because of conflict and because of difficult things. It's not to say that all of marriage is lonely, but that marriage is not a cure for loneliness. So Paul says it is good to be alone. And he says, each one has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. So this is where people get this idea of the gift of singleness, right? The gift that no one wants to receive, right? This is, you guys have heard this, right? The gift of singleness, and people wonder, do I have this? Did God, like, give me this gift, and can I give it away? Can I re-gift it to someone else? Can I, like, bring it to the next white elephant party, and somebody unwraps it? Oh, yay, the gift of singleness! But I don't think that's really what Paul's talking about here. I think actually we tend in general with the whole idea of gifts in the Bible to think a lot more narrowly than I think Paul probably did. And so it's helpful to think about singleness as a gift that is yours when you have it, and who knows how long you'll have it. That this season of singleness is a gift, whether or not, I don't think there is a gift of singleness. Your gift of being single for some period of time may last longer than others. It may last forever, but whatever it is, when you are single, to view that as a gift that you've been given. So what does that mean? How can singleness be a gift if all of these things are true? Well, there are some things that you can learn, and there are some things that there are advantages about being single. So I wish when I were single that I had better learned how to really be alone. Because I think that would have prepared me for marriage in ways that I needed to be prepared. Because I thought that this feeling of being alone was something that marriage would solve. So my approach was just, I just got to wait it out, right? I got to wait out any loneliness I feel until that time when I won't feel lonely anymore. Instead of saying, okay, what does it look like to be lonely? What does it look like to be alone? How do I be alone well? How do I find God when I'm alone? And if I'd learned that better as a single person, I think I would have entered marriage a lot more capable of feeling the things that I felt in marriage and not having it drag down my relationship in the process. So we can learn to be alone. I think you can learn to trust God in singleness when you're alone in ways that you sometimes can't, right? It's like, you know, if you really like cake and you're sitting at a table and there's a cake there, then you're like, man, I really want that cake, right? You with me? You really want that cake. So how do you learn not to want a cake? You go where there is no cake, right? So this is maybe a poor analogy. I feel like I'm ruining this. Point is, when you're married, there's this temptation, because there's another person there, because there's someone that you can kind of push all your needs on, there's a greater temptation to just look to that person and say, that this person's going to meet my needs. If I'm lonely, they solve it. If I'm tired, they solve it. If I'm upset, they're going to solve it. If I'm whatever, they're going to solve it. Whereas when you're not married, you don't have that temptation. And so you can really say, how do I bring this to God? What does it look like to relate to God, to trust Him in situations? I have here a list of, this is a list that Scott Grant made. Scott is one of the pastors here. He had a season of singleness, and when he got married, he made a list of all the things he learned, which is longer than I can read all of them tonight, but it's an interesting list. One of them is this. I like some of the way he phrases it. I'll be reading several of them throughout the evening. The mystery of the future is a great opportunity to believe in God's goodness. The mystery of the future is a great opportunity to believe in God's goodness. And that's, I think, part of this opportunity of being single, of wondering, where is God going to lead me and how am I going to trust him in that? So another way of being single is good, where you have the opportunity to invest yourself in things where you might not have the opportunity. This is what Paul refers to later in 1 Corinthians 7. We won't read this section because it's similar, but in verse 32 he says, "I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about worldly things, how to please his wife, and his interests are divided. And the unmarried or betrothed woman is anxious about the things of the Lord," etc. So the point is, when you're single, you have opportunities to invest in people and things, your time, your money, your energy, in ways that you might not when you're married or when you have children. And I will confess that at times I brag about you guys in Yath. Maybe it's not right, but I boast about this community. Not that I've done this amazing thing, but I boast about you guys. And the thing that I'm always boasting about for you guys is this fact, that you guys are a community that invests everywhere. And that, I think, is the sign of a healthy community, that you guys are in children's ministry, you're in youth ministry, you're helping in recovery ministry, you're going to anti-trafficking things. All over the place, you guys, I see you doing this. I see you taking advantage of the life stage you're in and pouring into other people because of that. And that's an awesome thing. And I think you ought to be encouraged and affirmed because of that. That's not true of all young adults. That's not true of all people when they're single. It can be a very hedonistic and self-serving time. So it really encourages me to see you guys plugging into other things. So, way to go. Here endeth my affirmation. All right. The other thing you can do, and this is a big one, is when you're single, you can learn to wait. And I think this is probably one of the biggest things that we all need to learn to do. How do you wait well? Because it's not as if once you get married, there will be no more waiting. It's not as if singleness is the only season you wait for. And waiting is one of the hardest things, I think, to just live in that state of wanting something and yet not having it yet. And there's this balance of being honest with your desire, not saying, "Oh, I don't really want it. You know, I'm fine. I'm okay." Admitting, yes, I do want this, and yet being content with where you are, juggling that tension. So I have an example. So many of you know that I've already planned out my midlife crisis that will occur in approximately 3 years. And my midlife crisis will involve me purchasing a convertible. So I look around, I think, I've talked a lot of you, what are good convertibles? And I've always wanted to do this. I've borrowed some of your convertibles and I drive around and it's very fun. But I think actually, and I hold this up as like the one area in my life that maybe I'm doing this well amidst the myriad of poorer examples. But I actually am enjoying the process of waiting to own a convertible. So I don't know if you can grasp this, but I actually think, you know, this is fun. Like, I know, so the kind of plan is when my kids are a little bit older and we eventually we have to get another car, I'll get a convertible that I'll drive and then they can drive my big car that'll have like 700,000 miles on it by then. So I actually am kind of in this state where I'm like, this is fun to think at some point in my life I will probably own a convertible. I can look forward to that. I don't know when it will be. I don't know what it will be. I don't know what it will look like. But I can appreciate that anticipation. And I can actually enjoy it. I'm not particularly anxious. I'm not like every day like having to not go to the car dealership and buy a convertible now. I'm not going crazy about it. I'm just like, this is going to be fun in a few years, some season, to have a convertible. And so I think that's maybe a model of what it looks like to wait well, to actually, if it's possible, enjoy the anticipation of waiting. Because the truth is that most people, and this is not a promise, it's not God's guarantee, but It is true, I think, that if you really want to be married, I think God generally gives that to you. If you look around, most people that pursue marriage end up married. Now, it may not be in your timing. It may not be the way you want it to work out. There may be all sorts of things that don't meet your expectations. But, you know, if I am reasonably careful, I can buy a convertible at some point in my life. And I think if you have a strong desire to get married and you bring that to God, then I think He will generally grant that to you. So then you can rest in God's goodness. Now, you know, maybe in 3 years, I won't want a convertible, right? Maybe I'll change my mind. I'll be like, you know, convertibles are stupid. I don't want to, maybe I want a motorcycle, right? Maybe that'll be my midlife crisis. Or maybe I'll just say, you know, my regular car's fine. I mean, maybe I'll change my mind, and that's fine. So I can enjoy, or maybe I'll get there and be like, you know, it's really not practical. I don't have the money, whatever. So I'm not going to get a convertible. So I can enjoy the anticipation now and appreciate it, even knowing, well, hey, maybe that'll change. Maybe Jesus will come back, right? And we'll be in heaven, and we'll all have convertibles. So like, it'll be a moot point, right? It doesn't matter. So the point is, there's this sense of waiting now that is actually, in some ways, enjoyable rather than torturous. And I think if we learn to do that as single people, then that can serve us really well in all sorts of areas of life. And I think the last thing is learning to be content. This is connected to waiting. Learning to be content when you don't have exactly what you want. Learning to say, this is what I have, this is what God's given me, and I'm okay with it. I'm happy with it. Because this also will serve you well in marriage. Because, you know, there's this old joke that women marry men thinking that they will change, and men marry women thinking they'll never change, and both sides end up being very disappointed. Because the person you marry is not the person that you will be married to 25 years from now. And so, you know, you might look around and say, I thought I picked the person I wanted, but they changed on me. And they're no longer exactly the person that I would have picked. What do you do then, right? And so this place of saying, God's given me this gift right now in this season, and I'm going to learn to appreciate it, learn to be content with it, learn the things I can learn in this season, is a really good thing to learn. So, another one of Scott's phrases is this. I think I quoted this one. Can't find it. He said, marriage is not the answer. It is just one more step on the journey. Marriage is not the answer. It is just one more step on the journey. And so if you think about all these things, right? And if you think that this list will be wiped clean when you get married, then you're actually probably wrong, right? I could pause the tape and say, my parents still annoy me at times. There are still brunches that you won't be invited to, even if you're married. Sometimes you're both sick and you will have to drive to CVS by yourself. Valentine's Day sometimes isn't fun when you're married either. Constantly moving. I mean, all these things, like, the point is not that marriage is bad. The point is that life is hard. And marriage is a step, and marriage is really good, but marriage brings new challenges, and it's just kind of a season. And so it's a good season, it's a season to look forward to, but marriage doesn't solve the problems of your life. So, we're going to move on. Paul's basic point here, then, is to seek contentment. Try to find what God has for you here, whether you're single or dating or engaged or married or divorced or whatever. Find this season that you're in and say, this season is a gift to me from God. What does it look like to be content with it, to live in this gift? Paul goes on to talk about marriage, married couples, and he says, to the married I give this charge, not I but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this one because It's covered in other places more clearly, but this is basically a statement of the permanency of marriage. So when Paul says here, not I, but the Lord, he's not implying that his other statements have lesser validity. He's just saying that he's actually quoting a statement of Jesus's here, that Jesus himself spoke about this issue. And so he's referring to Jesus's words and simply that marriage is a covenant. Marriage is a commitment. And it is that lifelong, permanent aspect of marriage that makes it what it is, makes it so powerful, and makes it the context that God can really work. So then he has this third section where he talks about relationships between a Christian and an unbeliever. To the rest, I say, and here he says, I, not the Lord. And again, that's not him saying this is a lesser instruction. It's simply that the Lord didn't speak on this topic. To the rest, I say that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? There's a lot of stuff here. We don't have the time to go into all of it. But I want to make a few observations. Paul is speaking specifically about a category that existed in that culture of Christians, new Christians probably, because there were almost only new Christians at this point, new Christians that were married to spouses who were not Christians. And so he's addressing that. He's essentially saying a few things. He's saying that's a difficult situation. He's acknowledging it's hard to know what to do in that situation. It's a painful situation to be married to somebody who does not share this fundamental thing. But he's saying there can be spiritual benefit there. He says you don't know what's going to happen out of this relationship. You don't know what spiritual benefit you might offer your unbelieving spouse. And there seems to be this notion that as a believer in a home, you offer something of God's presence to that home so that the whole home is somehow infected by God. That's this phrase, the children are not unclean, but they're holy. I'm not sure we experienced that in my house, but anyway. And the last thing he says, he talks about this freedom. If you're married to an unbeliever and the unbeliever wants to leave, you can let them. You don't have to coerce somebody to stay with you. You don't have to force them. You give them the freedom to say they can leave. So, most of you are not married to non-Christians. So then this question of, well, how do we apply this to ourselves? So how do we apply these statements? And we can see they probably have some analogy to what does it look like to date a non-Christian. And that's, of course, a big issue as you're dating and as you're single. But how do we apply it? We can't make perfect applications because this is a different situation. But I'll make some suggestions. First of all, I think Paul's advice would be don't marry a non-Christian. He sets up this category, says this is a difficult situation. It's hard to figure it out. It's hard to figure out what to do. It's hard to persist in it. So he would say, why would you choose that? Why would you go into that? Now, I don't think that dating a non-Christian is a sin. I don't think marrying a non-Christian is a sin. I don't think that you're violating some standard there. I just think Paul would say, and Jesus would say, it's a bad idea, right? This is not a wise thing. I think this is an issue of wisdom, but it's an issue of saying, is this really what I want? Is this lifestyle what I want? And I thought I'd point out that I've seen a lot of relationships between Christians and non-Christians in dating, and I've seen how they resolved. And in my experience, there's basically four possible outcomes. All right, so if you're a Christian and you say, I'm going to date a non-Christian, these are essentially the four ways that it could resolve. One is that the non-Christian becomes a believer. And that's part of what this talks about. So who knows, right? You might have a spiritual benefit on this person you're dating. And that does happen. It doesn't happen often. When it does happen, it can be complicated because there's issues of, am I converting to God or this person or what's really going on? So this is I am 100% convinced that God works in this way at times, and when he does, it's an amazing thing, but it's not the most common outcome. Second outcome is that two people get married. That person with a strong faith in Christ marries an unbeliever, and their dating relationship proceeds on to marriage, and they get married, and now you have the situation that Paul is talking about. And these principles would then apply. Those are difficult situations. I've known lots of people. We have several people at the church that are married to non-Christians, and it's a source of conflict. It's a source of struggle. It's not impossible. It's not unbearable. Community comes around you, but it's an added complexity that makes life difficult. Third option, and I'd say that outcome is fairly rare as well. That usually, if a Christian is dating a non-Christian, they don't get married in that state. I'd say the third option is the more frequent case, where the Christian ends up either losing their faith or deciding they're kind of sidelining their faith or saying, this is not really that important to me, and my boyfriend or girlfriend or fiance doesn't matter to them, so it becomes less and less important. I'd say this is probably the most common outcome that I've seen. I had a conversation early on in ministry when I was an intern. I was doing college ministry, and there was a college student who was a great guy, had a strong faith in Christ, and he had met this girl, and he made appointments with like everybody in leadership and said, I really like this girl, I want to date her, what should I do? And he just went down the line, and we're all like, yeah, that's really not a good idea. So he'd have lunch with the next person, and he'd be like, I really like this girl, what should I do? Yeah, that's really not a good idea. She just went through, and like everybody said the same exact thing. What did he do? He dated the girl. And now he's kind of completely abandoned his faith. And it's sad, because this was something that was important to him, and you kind of asked for advice, and we gave it, and that's often what happens. Not all the time. As I said, there are other outcomes, but that's a common outcome. And the fourth possible ending is that you break up, right? You date for a while, you break up, go your separate ways. So of those options, really only one of them is great, right? I mean, it's great if God works in somebody's life through a relationship and they come to faith. But the great option is the most rare option, and even it is complicated. I think even that option could be better if that was a friendship. So, but you say, but, you know, I really like this person. Like, I really connect with them. Or, I'm getting older, and maybe there's not going to be someone that comes around, and kind of maybe it's this person, or the gift of singleness is what I unwrap, right? Like, but, I mean, those things are fear-based, right? It's like, I'm afraid I'm not going to find somebody better. I'm afraid that I'll be single forever. I'm afraid that if I pass up on this, there'll be nothing else. But that's not how we're meant to live, to make decisions based on fear, to make decisions on what could be or could not be. It's a call to trust God. And it's a call to say, hey, God's going to provide for me. God's going to do good things. So, you know, this is a complicated topic. As I said before, I don't think there's a hard and fast rule for this. I don't think if you are dating a non-Christian, or if you have, or if you want to, I don't think it's as if kind of the whole community needs to shun you and, oh, this is the worst thing. Or, I mean, I think God can work in those situations, and I've seen him do so in amazing ways. So the last thing I'd want to say about this is, if you do want to do this, if you're inclined, if you know somebody and you're actively thinking about this right now, please don't, because I just spent time suggesting why it's a bad idea, walk away and be like, oh my God, I'm never going to talk about that now because Paul just said this is a bad idea, so I'll never share it with anybody. Because you're a person, you're going to make your decisions whether, you know, you want to or not. And so talk about it. Invite people into it. There's no shame. And I think we want to be a community that supports each other, that respects each other's right to make decisions and walks alongside of you and doesn't shun you and say, oh, you can't do that. That's, you know, maybe we'll say, hey, that's not a great idea, but hey, we'll support you in it and we'll still be your friend and you can still talk about it. And the worst thing, I think, is sometimes when people do this, then they're ashamed and so they isolate themselves from their Christian community and that process just gets exacerbated. Or they don't want to talk about it, they feel embarrassed, or they know people might disagree with it, and so then they run away, and that's not good either. So I think there are some things we can learn here, but ultimately, the things we learn here are the same things. It's not just finding a Christian to marry. It's not just like, oh, you're a Christian? Great! You know, will you marry me? Like, it's not how it works, right? Like, this whole process of finding somebody that is a good fit for you, it's a long process and it can be complicated. And the whole thing, whether you're looking for somebody who's a Christian or whether you're trying to find somebody that shares interests or just somebody you connect with, all of it is about trusting God and about learning in that His timing is right and that He will take care of you. Sometimes you need to break up with people because you're holding on to something that's not right. Sometimes you need to say no if somebody is interested or initiates because that's not a good fit. And you need to trust God that there's something better. Sometimes you need to wait for someone else, even if there's somebody who is a Christian, and you think, well, you know, this isn't the best fit, but maybe it's all I'm going to get. Sometimes you can say no. And sometimes you need to say yes. And sometimes you need to stay together. And sometimes you need to move forward and have the courage to take the next step. And all of these things. Sometimes you just need to trust God, whether it's saying no or yes or maybe or wait or whatever. It's all about finding God in the midst of where you're at. So, I think for me, those moments in college where I was lonely and didn't have anybody to eat lunch with and didn't want to study, so I just drove off by myself, I think I did find God in those moments. I wish now that I had appreciated it more at the time, but I actually look back at those moments with more fondness than sadness. Those times of just kind of being sad, but being sad with God and relating to Him in it and saying, actually, that something happened in those times, something special, something maybe even holy, where I met with God in a way that I often don't anymore. So we can find God in whatever season we're in. We can appreciate whatever season God's given us, and we can invite Him into it. So I'll pray, and then we'll spend some time discussing. God, thank you for your presence in our lives. Thank you that you're with us in different seasons. Thank you that we can trust you to be good to us, whether we're single or married or somewhere in between or something else entirely. God, help us, though. It's hard to find you. It's hard to find you amidst feelings of loneliness or conflict. But you're there, and so I pray that you would be guiding us and directing us. In Jesus' name, amen.